The Book Nook on WISO is made possible by five local library systems in Southwest Ohio: the Greene County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Clark County Public Library, the Dayton Metro Library, and the Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We've got the Book Nook coming up for you, and today we'll be talking to Jeb Card. He's a professor at Miami University, and he's got a new book out that he edited. And we're also going to be talking to him about his lecture, which he will be delivering today at Fort Ancient Earthworks and Nature Preserve in Oregonia. And he'll be talking about Ohio's strange connection to the lost continent of Mu. He'll be talking about evidence allegedly attributed to Mu, essentially the Pacific version of Atlantis. That's coming up this morning in the Book Nook after NPR News. Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today my guest is Jeb Card. And Jeb is one of the editors of a new book called Lost City, Found Pyramid: Understanding Alternative Archaeologies and Pseudoscientific Practices. Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
Jeb, how did this book come about? This is kind of an unusual book.
Yeah, I helped organize, co-organized with my co-editor David Anderson, who teaches in Virginia at Roanoke, in 2012. So of course there was the whole Maya 2012 business, which we made a point to make sure wasn't in the book, because I mean, it's got an expiration date quite literally. But there was a lot of interest in pseudo-archaeology or alternative archaeology, and actually that sort of the fight between those terms kind of ended up in the topic and concept, or in the title, and concepts of pseudoscience. Now, what's weird is I'm a co-host on a podcast called Archaeological Fantasies, and we recently did an episode about the sort of the post-election situation, where in the 2016 election there was all this discussion of, you know, this quote-unquote fake news and you know, conspiracy theories went a lot more mainstream than they had been and continue to. A lot of this stuff actually was even more relevant, but there was a fair amount of interest in certain circles in 2012. So for the Society for American Archaeology meetings in 2012, we put together this session on this topic, and I forget what the original title was. It was a lot more of a mouthful, but we invited a bunch of people. A lot of the people in this book spoke there. Some of the people who spoke were not able to bring themselves in, and some of the people we brought in after they spoke. So it's sort of, it's not just the conference, but that was kind of the catalyst. And in fact, we're doing another one this year at the Society for American Archaeology meetings in Vancouver in British Columbia. And we already do have some publication plans that I'm not sure I can go 100% into on that. But we did it. And what was really fun about that was, first of all, I got to meet some people. I'd only known their work. The room started to fill up. Like these are like these huge conferences where there's at any time 30 or 40 different sections going on. So like in the morning, there'll be 34 different sections, another 34 in the afternoon, or possibly more. I actually don't know the real number, but thousands of people go, thousands of people present. And usually these things start off and crowds wax and wane. Well, clearly we must have gotten word of mouth, because the room increasingly filled. This was in Memphis in Tennessee. The room increasingly filled as the morning went, which was nice to see. And people started saying, oh, there's this thing you got to go see. And by the end, it was pretty full. And so the Society for American Archaeology heard about this. They gave us a chance to talk about this a little in a special article in their SAA record. But we then approached the University of Alabama, and they very much were interested in wanting to publish this as a book. So I kind of pulled together all the people I've been sort of networking for years on. They write about these unusual topics, but from an academic perspective.
Some of our listeners are probably wondering, what the term pseudoscientific practices means.
Right. So, I mean, you know, it's both easy and hard to explain. I mean, the easiest way to explain, like the sort of textbook definition, would be somebody acting in a way that seems kind of sciency. There's a friend of mine, Sharon Hill, who talks about things sounding sciency, but isn't. It isn't necessarily following the scientific method. It isn't following necessarily like real rules of investigation and inquiry. And this could go all the way from, you know, if your listeners are old enough to remember the old, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that could technically be pseudoscience, but everybody knows the guy literally said he's not. But it could go anything from people doing things that have no relationship to science, but using symbols of science. And that could be things like lab coats, but usually it's things like language and certain kinds of activities, all the way up to, and where your boundaries get can sometimes be political discussion, you know, because people are like, well, wait a minute, what I'm doing is not pseudoscience. It's the edge of proper science, and others would disagree, to what your standards of evidence are. You know, are your standards of evidence and your practices those that are accepted by a larger professional or quasi-professional scientific community? So this could go all the way from people that trying to build cold fusion, and they say that there might be a scientific principle, but most of physics would not agree, to people that point to a Maya sarcophagus from the 7th century and say, ah, that's clearly a depiction of a spaceship, and then they get a TV gig on the History Channel.
Hmm. Explain how steampunk fits into all of this.
So this is an edited volume. David and I edited the volume, but we also have our own chapters. So most of the chapters in there are by our various contributors, but my own individual chapter is entitled Steampunk Inquiry, a Comparative Vivisection of Discovery Pseudoscience. It was supposed to be Comparative Autopsy, but after discussing that with the copy editor, they actually liked that better. So I mentioned that there was these two terms, alternative archaeology and people who like to say the word pseudo-archaeology. And my co-host, Ken Fader, uses a slightly more colorful term that I don't think I can repeat on your show, but we repeat on our podcast. There are people that look at those who say, well, maybe I can find evidence for King Arthur, or maybe there's these ideas that are outside of academia but are worth investigating. And there are people within archaeology, within professional archaeology, who say, look, shutting these down is a way of gatekeeping. And I think there's some truth to that. And you often see this where you see some people who are more hostile or less hostile to ideas of oral history. So there's actually debate about, is this part of the field? Is this something that we should be working against and so forth? And that's an important debate, but sometimes I think you can kind of get lost looking at individual trees and not see the larger forest. So this chapter was kind of comparing a lot of these kinds of practices to other sort of similar practices, people that go looking for Bigfoot and who study flying saucers and things like that. Because I think that there is a relationship to a lot of what sometimes gets called pseudo-archaeology or alternative archaeology to things that are not science but sometimes claim to be. And I found the concept of steampunk. This is a cultural idea. You see, you know, there's novels and movies and fashion that often takes the Victorian period for its influence, but it has a sci-fi element, sort of like a Victorian period that never was, retrofuturism. I found it to be a really useful metaphor for what a lot of these folks are doing, where their big issue is often being gatekept, being kept out of sort of being able to do archaeology by professionals. And that may sound harsh, but if you're destroying archaeological sites or you're appropriating somebody else's culture and turning it into your fantasies of giants or aliens or whatever, which has nothing to do with reality, they often turn to the Victorian period because it was in many times before you had professionals and experts and gatekeepers. A lot of this is actually about sort of issues with authority, issues with expertise, issues with professional structures of science. So I found that to be a really useful metaphor for that concept.
My guest is Jeb Card. Jeb is a professor at Miami University in Oxford, and he's an editor of Lost City, Found Pyramid, Understanding Alternative Archaeologies and Pseudoscientific Practices. You found something over there at Oxford, didn't you? Tell us about that.
I did. And we touch on this, I think, a little in the book, if I remember right, but it's not a major focus. It is going to be in a book I'll have coming out later this year called Spooky Archaeology with University of New Mexico Press. I have turned in the final draft, and we're just working on the editing stuff. But a couple years ago, I was teaching a course involving our old museum collections. In fact, I'm going to a later iteration of that course in about an hour. And I was going through our museum records, and I found reference to 4 stones found in Azcapotzalco, in what's now basically the outskirts of Mexico City, related to the lost continent of Mu. And you might be going, what the heck is the lost continent of Mu? I've never heard of that. And there's a good reason. It doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I have 4 stones of an original 2600 that you can, if you start poking around in sort of the weirder parts of history, you find people talking about this in the last century, and you'll see people believe in various sort of what are often not considered, you know, mainstream historical or archaeological thoughts talking about this. We had 4 in our basement.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a fascinating case study. And I'm actually going to be presenting this to my class in a little bit. And I'll be talking about that at Ford Ancient in early March. But basically talking about what are these things? How did they get here? Why do they exist? And what can we learn about sort of the past and archaeology from these things that I very strongly believe, based on all sorts of evidence, that they were made in the early 20th century.
That's right. You just mentioned you're going to be giving a talk as part of the Fort Ancient Lecture Series. This will be on March 4th from 10:30 in the morning until 12 noon Fort
That's,
Ancient.
It's going to be at the Fort Ancient Visitor Center. Fort Ancient is an archaeological site, and it's actually the type site for what gets called the Fort Ancient Culture, which is basically the equivalent of the Mississippian, what's often called Mississippian culture in the eastern woodlands. But it's after about 1,000 CE, so about from 1,000 years ago until European contact. And I'll be giving a talk there about these. And so I don't want to give everything away.
Mm-hmm, right.
But no, they were found in They come out of the excavations of William Niven, he was a geologist and an amateur archaeologist, although he ended up digging up vast amounts of earth and selling lots of artifacts as well as donating to museums in the early 20th century. And that's kind of the connection to here. And again, I'll talk about that in the talk. But yeah, it'll be on March 4th, and I'll sort of, you know, answer these questions. And I have asked my chair if I can bring them, and the answer is yes. I don't know if I'll bring all of them. Yeah, I keep some in a safe place. But no, I will actually bring these things. There were 2,600 of them originally in the 1920s, and a lot of people are interested in them. Like, they all disappeared. Now, there are actually a handful at Harvard, like literally 6.
Uh-huh.
So then there's these 4, and I've actually recently discovered a couple more in museums, and then there's some other developments that have happened. But I'll talk about those at the presentation.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. We'll continue our conversation with Jeb Card right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and joining me on the program today is Jeb Card. We actually had a guest on recently who wrote a novel called The Great Forgetting, and the lost continent of Mu is a very,
really?
It's a very important part of the story. His name's James Renner. He's from Akron.
Okay, does he also write about crime novels?
Yes, true crime, yep.
Yes, I think he's also written, if I remember correctly, I could be wrong, he wrote a novel that involved the Loveland Frog, which is not terribly far from me, a piece of folklore down here. I could be wrong about
that. The Man from Primrose Lane.
Yes.
It's being turned into a TV series on ABC.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
The Loveland Frog. You're good. We had him on for that book, too.
Yeah. No, it's a thing that I've been wanting to poke into.
Wow.
It's the concept of, and this will be a good chunk of the talk. I can talk about it a tiny bit, but the concept of the continent of Mu comes out of good and bad scholarship in the 19th century. There was a French, and I always mangle my French, so, you know, I speak Spanish, but not so much the French. But the Abbé Bresser de Bourbourg, he found numerous major important finds in archives, like one of the only handful of remaining pre-Hispanic Maya books, hieroglyphic books, the codices, in archives. And the very famous, the Popol Vuh, he found one of the examples of it from the colonial period, this very important text. He also had some weird ideas about Atlantis and other things and tried to decipher Maya hieroglyphs. And he particularly found what ends up being, to some degree, the Rosetta Stone, the Relación de las Cosas de Yucatán, de Diego de Landa, that is sort of the Rosetta Stone of Maya hieroglyphs, but he didn't understand what he was looking at. Mm-hmm. And in his attempts to translate Maya hieroglyphs, he made the sound, he said that there was this word mu, M-U, that was the name of Atlantis. He was obsessed with the idea of Atlantis and thought that all of Maya hieroglyphs encoded secret information about Atlantis. And so a lot of people wrote him off as an eccentric, but he inspired others like Augustus and Alice Lepongeon, some of the earliest archaeologists in the region, the Maya region, but who also had ideas like about this and reincarnation. They believed that an ancient reincarnation, an ancient version of Alice Lepongeon, was Queen Mu. Mm-hmm. And then she went to Egypt and Atlantis and built the Sphinx, if I remember correctly, and all of this. And they wrote novels or stories, or, well, I mean, we start to get into tough terminology here. And this, and then inspires some other things. And again, I'll talk more about that. It's just more that gets complicated. But this ends up finally being crystallized by a guy who calls himself Colonel James Churchward, who was an occultist, was into all these kinds of ideas of what's called theosophy. Theosophy was this notion, it was an actual movement, most famously Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, this Russian or Ukrainian mystic, that tried to unify religions, tried to create a sort of, tried to reconstruct the idea there must have been some ancient singular religion and tried to reconstruct it. And there were actually quite a few early anthropologists that were interested in this, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Churchward was sort of playing on that, and there was this sort of pattern of finding a text that nobody else could see. She had the Book of Zion that nobody else has seen, but she said she had it and was the only person who could translate it. Well, Churchward, he had his Nakhal tablets in India that supposedly he was the only, and this is his phraseology, white man to have ever been shown them, and only he had the translations, and of course nobody had ever seen them. Mm-hmm. And he said that they recorded the lost continent of Mu. And that word sounds a lot like Lemuria. There was this idea of another sunken continent. This is all before plate tectonics. So it was this idea that rather than plates moving around, the continents sunk and rose a lot. And Lemuria had been invented in the 1860s, if I remember correctly, I could be wrong on that date, to explain why there are lemurs on both sides of the Indian Ocean. And there was the idea that there had been this continent. And this was seized upon by Blavatsky and others. Well, he sort of created his own, the Lost Continent of Mu, a Pacific version of Atlantis. And I've talked with his great-grandson, Jack Churchward, who has been doing research into his famous ancestor, and he's skeptical of a lot of this as well, as he describes in his podcast and his blog up on his show. But he creates this, and then he sees in the newspaper these stones that Niven is showing. And he goes, ah, those are just like the Nakhal tablets I can't possibly show you. And that's how these all start to get melded together.
Mm-hmm. Jeb Carr joins us. The book is Lost City, Found Pyramid, Understanding Alternative Archaeologies and Pseudoscientific Practices. And he is one of the editors of this book, recently published by the University of Alabama Press. And you can meet him and hear him speak at the Fort Ancient Lecture Series on March 4th from 10:30 in the morning until 12 noon. And he'll be coming over from Miami University to talk about Ohio's strange connection to the lost continent of Mu. And I didn't realize here in Southwest Ohio, we have so many of these ancient mounds. And I didn't realize until I read your book and the essay about mounds that the interest in mounds kind of declined after it was revealed that the pseudoscientific aspects were not true.
Right. So this is one of these things I love teaching my students. You know, I am in Oxford. There were smaller mounds around here. There's actually quite a lot of them, and a lot were lost in the 19th and early 20th century. And if you go down to Riley, 5 minutes south of here, in a cemetery, there is an earthen mound. It's not very large, but there is. You go right near Dayton, of course, there's Miamisburg Mound, which is freaking huge.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's about 70 feet tall. It is, in essence, a pyramid. Now, it's not made of stone. It's made of earth. But it's a pyramid. There was a burial under it. It's not related to Egypt. It's a lot later and has nothing to do with that. Pyramids, you know, that gets into whole, you know, what's a pyramid? Well, it's a vaguely cone-shaped, maybe, you know, it's a very vague term, and people try to make a lot. It's like, there's pyramids here, there's pyramids here. Well, you just pile sand on a beach. You just made a very, very, very small pyramid. But this is a large earthwork, and of course, we've got the Chillicothe site. We've got, very famously, it's not a pyramid, but we have Serpent Mound, an effigy mound. But students don't know this. People don't know this. It's like, yeah, did you know there's a pyramid in the southwestern part of Dayton? And students, then they start to really want to do that. And the thing is, before 1800, generally, at least some people understood, you know, in like European settlers, what these were. But around 1800, as you start to have new American settlers moving across into Ohio, and remember, this was actually part of one of the reasons why they were struggling with the British Empire and resulting in the American Revolution, is they wanted to move west, and the empire was like, well, we have indigenous allies, you can't. After the Revolution, they start moving west, they start running in these mounds, and rather than say, and this is something you've seen in a lot of colonial contexts, very famously Great Zimbabwe in southern Africa, rather than say, oh, clearly these people that we are in conflict with made these wonderful things, they appropriate them for themselves. And this thing emerges called the mound builder myth in the 19th century. Very famously in his State of the Union address, if I remember correctly, Andrew Jackson cites this to justify the Indian Removal Act, to justify the Trail of Tears. In essence, the idea that, oh, clearly this is super civilized. These people we don't like, we don't think they're civilized. Therefore, they didn't build it. And probably people like us, and that was usually very explicitly racially coded as white, built it. And so there was this long idea that the people who had been here for over 18,000 years, probably 20,000 years, had not built these things and had instead come here recently and had killed off the civilized people by their telling. This is me basically explaining this idea. It's not me agreeing with it. And this was huge in the 1800s, in the 19th century, to the point where this was the first federal research into archaeology. Because there was such great interest in this, Congress apportioned money to investigate this. And around 1890, which I think is not coincidentally about the time the frontier was considered closed, archaeology started to professionalize and said, wait, no, indigenous people built these. Thomas Jefferson, over a century earlier, had come to something of a similar conclusion as arguably America's first archaeologist. But around 1890, you have Cyrus Thomas and others basically come to the conclusion that that's what we're looking at. And then when that becomes clear, it's like, oh, clearly indigenous people built these, people stop paying attention to them, which is why a lot of people are like, there's a pyramid here? Really?
Fascinating. My guest is Jeb Card. I think one of my favorite chapters is the one about Peru.
Oh, yeah. Stacy Dunn, a good friend of mine. What did you like about that?
I had no idea this was going on there. I think that the mingling of living people and long dead people and just the way that they interact, I thought was fascinating.
Yeah. The chapter is basically about the reuse of ancient archaeological sites and ancient archaeological remains in modern religious and magical practices, and the sort of the porous borders between people who scientifically dig, people that end up looting for profit, people that loot for, or they take things and collect things for interest, and how they use it to create identity, how they use it to do religious practices, how those religious practices are given power by using archaeological remains by sort of inherently being something of sort of the mythic realm for many people. I mean, people in my profession are like, well, this is just stuff made by everyday people. But that's actually not how a lot of people see archaeology. They often see it as of origins, and origins are inherently of mythic or importance. And mythic here doesn't mean like Mythbusters. It doesn't mean it's fake. It means it has an important resonance for how things are. And archaeology does a lot of that. So yeah, no, that chapter, I very much had to, you know, there was some discussion like, does this fit? I'm like, this absolutely fits. I think this actually really sets the stage beautifully because it does show how people interact with the past.
I can remember studying ancient history back in the day and being told about Heinrich Schliemann and mm-hmm. the excavations at Troy. And always thinking what a great archaeologist he was. And then I just discovered in your book a passing reference to the fact that he was using dynamite. I had no idea.
He did. And he also dug through what he wanted. So he wanted Troy at its splendor. You know, he wanted this. And he also thought of it as – so this is also when the concept of the West is being invented. You know, so that's not – you know, all these ideas are created by people for reasons, for social and political reasons. And the idea of Europe against not Europe was sort of being created. And so we had this idea, this must be at the base of European civilization. Therefore, the most important part must literally be on the bottom. So he dug all the way through, literally through the city, like the sort of the height of the Bronze Age, that if there was a Trojan War, would have been the one you're looking for. He also conglomerated stuff, like his famous Priam's treasure, where you see all these beautiful gold and other objects together. He actually took from several contexts and stuck together, it seems. I mean, there's some debate about that, but generally the historical record suggests he was creating myth for himself and others in many ways. I mean, there's that famous picture, the stuff from Priam's treasure is being worn by his wife.
Right.
That's literally how he's presenting it to the world.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he was very much engaged in a lot of myth-making, but not in, like, saying things to fool people, but making the world more fascinating through his activities, even if that wasn't exactly accurate.
And if Heinrich was around today, he would have his own reality TV show.
Well, I mean, see, that's we talk about Schliemann, and there's this whole question of, do we group those together? Because when he was doing that, there were archaeologists that were more scientific than him, but there were a lot that were not. Like, the profession was still forming.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like, okay, this is part of that forming. Now, what exactly is your excuse for doing this and doing that? And that's where it gets to this whole, are we being too judgy, or are these practices part of archaeology? And I go back and forth with my colleagues who talk about this a lot. And one of the big things about this book, I think, is there are a few others like this, but I think there needs to be more because, frankly, this is what people, like I said, reality show. This is what people often think about the human past. They go to the History Channel. They see stuff on YouTube that is often done for other reasons, and we need to be, frankly, engaging with these ideas more, even if they're things that, for us, are like, well, this has no scientific basis. Like, yeah, but you know what? If this is what is out there, we can't just go, oh, that's garbage, and like leave it alone. It's like, no, why do people believe this? What is this doing for people? Why is this important?
Yeah, truly. And it's the weird side of archaeology, and you obviously take great delight in talking about it. And you mm-hmm. also mentioned earlier that you have another book coming out later in the year, Spooky Archaeology, Myth and the Science of the Past. We have just enough time to,
to
hear.
Yeah, University of New Mexico. It should be like right around Christmas. I was hoping to get it around Halloween, I think, for obvious reasons.
Mm.
But I kind of got sort of stuck doing a bunch of different things in the last few months, so it's been a little delayed. But yeah, it should be out at the end of the year. And that subtitle is probably the title. It's definitely going to be Spooky Archaeology, but the subtitle, we may have to tweak, you know, the last minute stuff. But yes, that'll be coming out. Now, that's a single author book. It's by me. It's not an edited volume. And it pretty much explores, like, I have a whole chapter on the Mu Niven stones in there where I go into great detail. You'll see some of that on the 4th, like what's in there. But I look at a lot of different cases. We look at archaeologists as detectives and spies. We look at how a couple of archaeologists actually helped create the whole ancient aliens idea we look at, you know, the Mummy's Curse and where that actually comes from and how it's a lot more real than you think, not in that there's an actual curse, but that it's a lot more anchored in history than you might imagine. It's not just from Hollywood. In fact, Hollywood early on was actually a lot closer than you might think. So it's about this and about why do these things? Why does the stuff that is not necessarily right, but that people are fascinated by, why does it exist? Where does it come from? And what does it tell us about the science of archaeology and why we care about the past?
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WISO. My guest has been Jeb Card, and he's going to be speaking as part of the Fort Ancient Lecture Series March 4th from 10:30 until noon at Fort Ancient, the National Historic Landmark. And he'll be bringing some of those mysterious stones from the continent of Mu with him. If you go, are you going to let people actually touch them?
We'll see. They're a little fragile. That's one of the reasons why it's kind of hard to believe they're 10,000 years old rather than, you know, being made in 1919. But I'll definitely have some of them there.
Well, we really appreciate your time today.
Thank you. This has been awesome. Thank you for having me on.
And that was Jeb Card talking about his work and his lecture, which he will be delivering today. That's right, at 10:30 this morning, March 4th. He will be speaking at the Fort Ancient Earthworks and Nature Preserve, 6123 State Route 350 in Oregonia. That's at 10:30 this morning. He'll be talking about Ohio's strange connection to the lost continent of Mu. And information is available at fortancient.org or 800-283-8904. We've got a treat coming up for you to close out the Book Nook today right after this. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Back in 2011, 6 years ago, I recorded an interview with Rebecca Skloot for her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, and it has been developed into a film which will be showing on HBO on April 22nd, starring Oprah Winfrey as the daughter of Henrietta Lacks. Let's listen now to an excerpt from my interview with Rebecca Skloot. It's an amazing story, and one of the most amazing things is that you were able to earn the trust of her family. That had to be the hardest thing of all.
It most definitely was. It took me about a year and a half to even convince her family to talk to me. She had 5 kids when she died, and they didn't know anything about these cells until the early 70s, when scientists came and tracked down Henrietta's children to do research on them with hopes of learning more about the cells. And you know, her husband had a third-grade education. He didn't know anything about what a cell was. And the way he understood this phone call was, essentially, we've got your wife. She's alive in a laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years, and now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientist said at all, but he just didn't have a reference point. He thought they had her in a cell like a prison cell.
Oh.
And so her family got sucked into this world of research they didn't understand. That was really traumatizing for them in a lot of ways. And then various other people came along wanting things. Everyone from, you know, researchers to con artists who tried to steal their medical records. I mean, the number of things that happened to them before I came along was astonishing. So it made perfect sense that they didn't trust me. A lot of that becomes part of the story in a way to show what they had been through before I came along.
Rebecca Skloot joins us. Her book is The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. And the strands in this story are almost as complex as the strands you'd find in DNA. I mean, there's just so many sub-stories here. You've got the story of Henrietta herself, which she was completely obscure. And then you've got her family story and her daughter, who you got very close to, Deborah. You just alluded to the fact that they came back and they wanted to do more research on the children, and she was convinced that she was going to get the same cancer her mother died from and was sitting there waiting for the results of her cancer test. And as a reader, we read this and we feel so sad and so sorry for these people to be put in so much pain and to feel so ignorant of the process.
In a lot of ways, I mean, the book is about so many different things, and one of the things it's about is the importance of access to information and education. And, you know, Henrietta's kids didn't really have that. And when scientists came along to do research on them, they didn't even try to explain what was going on. And when the family asked questions, the scientists didn't really answer them. And so one of the things that I think is important about the book is that it shows why it's important for the public to have access to education, particularly about science. I mean, science is such an important part of everyday life, and there are so many people who really don't understand it or are even afraid of it. So one of my goals in writing the book was really to have it be something that absolutely anyone could read, despite, you know, regardless of how much education they'd had, how much science, you know, whether they like science or not. Because I feel like that, you know, that is so much of the family story, is about the damage that can come with not having information about science.
Well, two of the really amazing things to me as a reader, a fairly unscientific reader, was the fact that these cells are still living and proliferating 60 years after they were originally taken from Henrietta, and the fact that these cells are cancer cells.
Right. And, you know, the fact that her cells are still alive is still a bit of a mystery. It's really, it's amazing. So we know that she had HPV, which is the virus that causes cervical cancer, and that that's what made her cells become cancerous in the first place. She also had syphilis, which can cause cancer to grow more rapidly. So there was something about the HPV and syphilis together that made her cells really grow. But there were a lot of people that had HPV and syphilis in the 50s, and their cells didn't just grow. So there was something about her cells that nobody knows to this day. And I often give talks at research institutions, and there will be this moment where I'm talking to a room full of scientists, and they'll sort of look at each other and go, we don't know that? Why don't we know that? Like, we know everything else about HeLa cells. And I think part of it is that they just, scientists have been trying to grow cells for so long that when they finally did grow, they just went forward. They didn't stop to say, why did that happen? They just kind of went forward with all their research. So hopefully, there are several scientists actually who are trying to get me a better answer to that question. They're actually now looking at why her cells grew when others didn't. And then the other part of your question about them being cancer cells, this is something that's often sort of mind-boggling to think about, that cancer cells could be used to do something like helping to create the polio vaccine or the various things that have nothing to do with cancer. You know, her cells went up in the first space missions to see what would happen to human cells in zero gravity. They were the first cells ever cloned. Hers were some of the first genes ever mapped. And the reason that her cells, even though they're cancer cells, can be used for that sort of thing is that there are some things about them that are normal. You know, cancer cells grow abnormally, and there's very certain things about them that are very strange and unusual. But they still do things that normal cells do. They make proteins, they divide, they, you know, they have a cell membrane. And so they're able to study what's normal about them. But in the case of HeLa cells, part of what makes them so valuable is the way that they grow. They're so hardy, and they grow fast. So you can infect them with a virus, like polio, and then the cells will grow and grow and grow and make more of the virus. So the virus will grow and grow inside the cells. So they're almost like a little factory. They can mass produce polio, and then you can extract it. So there are various things you can do with them that aren't related to cancer. But it is a bit of a stretch of the imagination to kind of understand that.
Well, your research is just incredible in this, because you go back and you follow the trajectory of these cells and the various scientists who have used them, and the whole growth in this industry of cell reproduction, and people who have done strange things, like this fella who was injecting cancer cells into people. And then you track down the whole family. You go back to the old home place in Virginia, and this is research where if you hadn't done it when you did it, you couldn't do it.
Yeah. That's one of the things that was, as a writer, was sort of the most haunting to me as I was working on the book, was this sense that I had this small window of time, and that I had come along right at the point when this history was vanishing. So Henrietta's generation, her cousins and her siblings and her husband, they were all dying. They were in their 80s and 90s, and same with the scientists. And there were times when I would do an interview, and then a week later, the person would die. Or I was supposed to do an interview, and they died before I talked to them. And so I constantly had this sense of scrambling after history as it was disappearing. And then, you know, I carried around quite a bit of weight on my shoulders in the end as I was working on the book, because I had this real feeling of, you know, I have all this information that is gone now. I'm the only person who has this, and I really need to do right by the history and telling the story. You know, one of the things in that realm that was amazing was there were a lot of scientists heard, you know, through friends that I was working on this book, and I would get letters in the mail, you know, from a scientist who was, you know, elderly, And they would often send me information just out of the blue that they thought would be useful to me because they'd heard about the book. And in one case, one scientist, he was a neurosurgeon, he had been diagnosed with brain cancer and he was dying. And he was cleaning out his file cabinets and he found a bunch of papers that were related to the early days of HeLa-cells, and he sent them to me with a letter that said, I'm dying and I want this to go to good use, so I'd like you to have this. And by the time I got it, he was gone. And those kinds of things happened all the time as I was working on the book, and it was very helpful for me in terms of keeping going, just realizing how important the story was and how many people felt it was important to get it out there.
Rebecca Skloot joins us. Her book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, has just come out in paperback. And I was amazed when you tell the story of going back to the old home place in Virginia that you'd been to many times before, and you went there and it was gone.
Yes, I talk about history vanishing as you're working on something. Yeah, the town where Henrietta grew up was razed. It was just completely destroyed at a certain point because the town had disbanded and most of the people who'd lived there had died. And the area where Henrietta lived, her they called it Lackstown, where her old house is, that is still standing, but the main street in the town was gone. Yes, completely. So now there are a few sort of shells of buildings left, but it's pretty much gone.
Another thing that amazed me was that Henrietta's husband actually lived a fairly long life. And when we think about the fact that Henrietta died with cancer and syphilis, and one might surmise that her husband probably had some health issues as well, but yet he lived into his 80s, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And, you know, he had diabetes and high blood pressure and sort of the things that are very common in inner city poor black families, and her kids have those things as well. But, yeah, he lived to be, might have even been his early 90s.
Wow.
When he died. He had syphilis, and he had it, you know, sort of off and on through his life. You know, it was one of those things he was treated for periodically. And yeah, he just lived out a very long, healthy life.
I see where you have created a foundation, the Henrietta Lacks Foundation. What does that do?
When I came along wanting to work on the story, I really started understanding what her family had been through. It was really important to me to not be another person who came along and potentially benefited from the story in the cells without doing something for the family. And so I started the foundation, and some of the book proceeds go in there. But it's also anyone can donate. So readers donate on a very regular basis. There's a website, just henrietta.lacks.org. So far, the foundation has given out grants for tuition and books. We've given out 8 of those to her grandkids and great-grandkids to go to school. We've been able to help with some medical expenses for some of her kids. But the mission of the foundation is actually broader than just helping the Lacks family, where its goal is to help people who are in financial need, who were used in research without their consent, people who made important contributions to science and didn't benefit and are really, you know, struggling. So the descendants of the Tuskegee syphilis studies, you know, where these hundreds of African American men were used in syphilis research without their knowledge, or, you know, there's unfortunately a lot of people who actually qualify. So that's what we're working towards.
When we get near the end of the book, you make several statements that say, as this book was going to press, etc., there was no law against this, there was no law about that. Since the book has gone to press, has any of this changed?
Not really. So people often ask, you know, so this couldn't happen today, right? And it does, in a sense. It happens all the time. You know, there are certain laws in place that say, you know, if your name is attached to cells like hers was, and if your cells are just taken for research, you have to get consent for that. But most tissue research is actually done on samples that are taken for other reasons, you know, a biopsy, a blood test. And if your identity is removed from it, so if it's anonymous and it was taken for something other than research, the leftover tissues from your biopsies and whatever can be used in research without consent, and often are. And nothing has changed about that. So there are still, you know, a large amount of research being done on tissues without people's consent. But what has changed is that people are starting to become aware of that and starting to ask questions. You know, I often say, if you're curious about what's happening with your tissues, just ask your doctor. You know, this part of the story is about that, about sort of asking for information, and if you don't understand it, saying so, reading the forms when they give them to you. But there's a lot of discussion about how to handle the laws and whether there should be consent required for all tissue research. And interestingly, there were several legal cases I wrote about in the afterword of the book that were settled after the book came out, and they all went in historically new directions, which were more toward requiring consent and disclosing potential financial gain. And so it does seem like there's a shift happening, but nothing official yet.
Well, let's just play the devil's advocate here. Let's say I go to the emergency room, and in the process of my treatment, they get some of my blood to test. Should I be concerned that my blood's going to end up somewhere where someone's going to look at it and go, oh, wow, this guy, he's got some unusual thing going on here. Let's send this to a laboratory and see if we can turn it into a product. I mean, is that a legitimate concern?
You know, it's definitely something that can happen, that research on tissue taken for the reason like that can be used in research. But concern, you know, no. I mean, one of the things that I often say to people when I go out and give talks is, you know, people will say, you know, should I go to the doctor? Should I get this biopsy? And the answer is yes, absolutely. What I don't want is for people to take this story and think, oh, I shouldn't go get these treatments because they might use my tissues for research. Really, it's just about asking. And, you know, we sign forms when we go to the hospital that say you can dispose of my tissues any way you see fit. You can use them in research. You know, so people can ask questions about that, and you can say, hey, no, I don't want you to use my tissues in research. But, you know, really what it comes down to more than anything, I think, you know, and we want this research to happen, by the way. This is, you know, where all of our future medications come from and vaccines. And I think really what it comes down to is that people just want to know. And people really do understand this is important research. It does not put you at risk for the most part. I mean, there's some risks, little risks for certain people. You know, maybe it's against your religion to have your tissues living on outside of your body. Or, you know, maybe people have individual reasons why they wouldn't want it to happen. But for the most part, people understand that it's important research, and they say, you know, as long as they ask, we'll say yes. You know, most of the lawsuits over this stuff, including, you know, the Lack family says the same thing, is we get this research is important. We want it to happen. We just don't want things happening without our knowledge. So I think it's more about people just wanting to know what's going on. You know, it's definitely not something to refuse treatment over. It's more something to simply ask your doctor.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, closing out our program with Rebecca Skloot talking about the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks, her bestseller that was published back in 2010, and it's just been developed into a film adaptation that'll be on HBO on April 22nd at 8 p.m., starring Oprah Winfrey as Deborah Lacks, the daughter of Henrietta Lacks, and playing the part of the journalist Rebecca Skloot will be Rose Byrne. And some other developing news. We closed out that interview right before I asked Rebecca Skloot if the family of Henrietta Lacks had ever sued about her missing cells and all the profit that's made from them over the years. And she said, no, they had never sued. Well, according to the Baltimore Sun this week, there is some litigation going on now. And this is from the Baltimore Sun, published on February 17th. The eldest son of Henrietta Lacks doubled down Friday on his efforts to reclaim his mother's legacy, calling for a congressional inquiry into John Hopkins Medicine's unauthorized use of her cells and the suspension of nearly $2 billion in National Institutes of Health funding. Lawrence Lacks, the executor of his mother's estate, said the years of research using his mother's cells helped the medical institution build its reputation and led to scores of studies and medical breakthroughs. All of this, in turn, contributed to the funding Johns Hopkins received and continues to get, Lacks and other family members said. In a statement, Lacks said he wanted a congressional inquiry into the money the medical institution made from her cells, known as HeLa cells, and called for the NIH to suspend $1.89 billion in research funding allocated to Johns Hopkins for 2017 during the investigation. The cells, collected from the 31-year-old Turner Station woman during a diagnostic procedure before she died of an aggressive form of cervical cancer in 1951, were the first to live outside the body in a glass tube. They have become the most widely used human cells that exist today in scientific research. Lawrence Lacks, 82, was not available for a phone interview, but his son Ron and nephew Alfred Lacks Carter spoke on his behalf. Quote, "The HeLa cells put Johns Hopkins at the top of the research chain worldwide," Ron Lacks said, and we're thinking that we need Congress to step in and stop Johns Hopkins until we find out what is going on. Lawrence Lax asserted Monday that the family wanted compensation from Johns Hopkins for its use of his mother's cells. His statements come as an HBO movie about his mother's life starring Oprah Winfrey is scheduled for release in April. So that's some litigation coming their way. And things getting a little messy there. Rebecca Skloot, according to the article, was not available for comment. Her publisher did make a comment, Crown Publishing. They said Skloot provided the manuscript to members of the Lax family for comment and corrections that were put into the book. And they're standing up for her version of Henrietta's history. And if you heard the first part of our interview today, that was with Jeb Card. He will be speaking this morning, March 4th at 10:30, about Ohio's strange connection to the lost continent of Mu. That's at Fort Ancient Earthworks and Nature Preserve at 10:30 this morning in Oregonia. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.